This is episode number one of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, February 22nd, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito. Up for discussion this week, Skype petitions the FCC for wireless net neutrality rules, the proposed XM Sirius satellite radio merger, and is the Spectrum Commons really a third way between regulation and privatization? Joining me to discuss these topics are Adam Thier.
Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Adam. Tim Lee.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey, and PJ Doland.
Howdy, Jerry.
Hello, PJ. These are contributors to the Technology Liberation Front all. First up, Skype and wireless net neutrality. Adam, you first wrote about the Skype petition on techliberation.com. Tell us a bit about what's going on here.
Yeah, well, Jerry, thanks. The Skype Corporation, along with some other academics, have been petitioning for the idea of Carter Phone-like rules or net neutrality principles to be applied to wireless. Carter Phone is an old FCC regulatory order from 1968 that dealt with device attachment to the old AT&T monopoly network. And, of course, everybody these days knows what net neutrality is, and so I won't go into that. But previously to the Skype petition that was filed at the FCC this week, no one was really seriously debating the idea of applying this all to the wireless industry or wireless networks. Skype's changed all that now, and along with Professor Tim Wu at the University of Columbia, has put forward petitions to basically extend this concept and apply regulations to wireless networks to essentially live like common carriers and basically have the FCC regulate terms of attachment and eventually, I think, the terms of pricing on those networks.
So wait, so what this means is, so right now we have a landline phone network, and if I wanted to attach a fax machine to that network, I can. If I wanted to attach a cell phone or an answering machine or a modem from whatever manufacturer, I can do that. But with a cell phone, I can't.
Right. In the world of cellular telephony, generally we deal with proprietary standards and exclusive attachments. It doesn't mean that you can't attach anything to your cell phones. Obviously, you can attach a variety of things. But there are certain conditions laid out per your contract with a cellular carrier, and there are certain rules about what kind of content you can access within the sort of miniature walled garden of current cell phones. Of course, all of this is new. A few years ago, you didn't have the ability to really attach much of anything or access much of anything with the clunky old phones we used to carry around. As that changes, some companies, especially, as you can imagine, someone like Skype, is interested in saying, well, we want to ride on top of this cellular network, and we don't necessarily, A, want to be restricted in any way from reaching our customers, or B, charged anything for reaching our customers. So that really is where the debate is heading, which is, do we need government regulation to somehow protect Skype or other types of applications riding on top of the cellular networks?
So explain a little bit better why Skype is interested in this.
Well, of course, Skype has a service that we're using right now for this podcast that operates over an internet platform that allows people to make free calls to one another. And conceivably, in the future, if your cell phone is internet capable, you would be able to potentially use Skype to directly call someone else without essentially paying anything to your existing cellular provider or using their traditional services in any fashion, except for the underlying infrastructure that the call is going over. So obviously cellular companies are a little uncomfortable with that idea, but it goes beyond that because, of course, at some point Skype would like to see the FCC impose certain regulations to say any kind of device or application should be able to ride freely on top of these networks. So basically, taking the Skype petition would take authority away from the cellular carriers to make determinations about who accesses their networks, on what terms, and at what price, and transfer that authority to the Federal Communications Commission to decide on behalf of the entire industry.
Adam, it seems to me you raised an important point there. It seems to me one of the maybe weaknesses or one of the ways that I think that this is a little bit premature is the Tim Wu paper actually talked about a bunch of different types of discrimination. And one distinction I think that's very important is between the Carter Phone device attachment rules on the one hand and the this network neutrality rule, which is more about what kind of data can flow across the network. The Skype petition, that's related to the latter, right? The network neutrality.
Right, right. Right, and but you're making a good point, because the Tim Wu paper we're referencing is a piece that Columbia professor Tim Wu wrote called Wireless Net Neutrality, that he published for the New America Foundation. And in that piece, he's talking about a lot of different kinds of activities or behavior he considers to be, quote-unquote, discriminatory or adverse to consumers. And one of them, for example, is cell phone locking. And this is something, maybe I'll toss it back to you, Tim, or even to Jerry, because you guys have written about this. And I, you know, the question here is, should a cellular carrier be allowed to lock you in via your handset to their specific service? Or should you have the quote-unquote freedom to use that device to go elsewhere and get some other type of service or access to other types of devices?
And I think it's important to point out that this is a little bit overblown, because as I understand it, there's four national carriers. Two of them use GPRS and two of them use GSM, and two different technologies for...
CDMA and GSM.
I'm sorry, CDMA and GSM.
Right.
But as I understand it, GSM is effectively a neutral technology, in that you've got a little SIM card in there, and you can transfer your SIM card from one cell phone to another, and the new cell phone becomes your cell phone.
I mean,
there is, as I understand it, the GSM phones can be locked to a particular SIM card, but both, I think it's Singular and T-Mobile, I think, are the two that use GSM.
Right.
Both of them, if you ask them, will unlock your phone after your contract up or whatever. So it is possible to get unlocked phones. It is possible to transfer phones, at least between those two networks. It's just a little bit of a hassle, and it costs more because it's not subsidized by the cell phone company, so most consumers don't do it. But it's not clear to me that you have an inalienable right to cell phone portability at a certain price. And
I think that what you said about the subsidization is key. These phones are $100 or $50 sometimes a piece because they're locked in. If the FCC passes a rule that says you can no longer lock in phones to a network, what consumers are going to see are the prices of cell phones skyrocket, because a cell phone carrier, especially prepaid carriers, can no longer just give you a cheap phone knowing that you're going to stick with their network and lock in with a contract. Basically, your freedom to contract with them is going to be taken away.
Well, Jerry, that's an irrespective
of whether you lock somebody into the phone. I mean, you see what Apple's doing with the iPhone. Whether or not there's any technological limitation of locking you into the phone, you're probably going to end up seeing more exclusive deals with carriers, and you're going to end up seeing, the only outlet to buy the phone is going to be through a long-term contract with a particular carrier. And even if you theoretically can transfer it, you might be locked into a contract that's so long that it's effectively irrelevant. Now, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. You know, we've all gotten used to receiving highly subsidized phones, and we're going to continue to receive subsidized phones whether or not, lock-in continues.
And the other point I wanted to raise to build on what Tim said a minute ago is that this question of the locking of phones, I mean, first of all, I wonder what's the average amount of time that people hold on to cell phones these days? I mean, usually after your contract is up, you're looking to up to the new one in town. I mean, you don't want to be carrying yesterday's clunker around in your pocket. So I don't know how much of a demand there is for unlocking, but okay, let's assume you do want to unlock. One of the things I did just for the hell of it is I went on to Google and searched for unlocking your cell phone and got about 1.4 million hits. And I went through page after page after page of all these things that show you exactly how to do it for your phones. And I think there is market demand there for it, but it's being satisfied. So what's the problem with having some approaches that maybe do lock you in, others that don't? I like that kind of experimentation between sort of open and closed systems, see which one prevails. I think the more open, unlocked systems will prevail. But as Jerry pointed out, I think it probably will cost more money if you do that, because they won't be subsidized by the carrier in those cases.
Hey, Adam, one last question before we move on to the next topic. And Tim, feel free to jump in here too. So Carter Phone, when it was passed back in 1968 by the FCC, ushered in this wave of innovation that was unprecedented. Why wouldn't it do that now? What's the difference between now and then?
Well, it's important to remember that we had a standardized, commoditized, regulated monopoly type of market where you had one black rotary dial telephone over which you made all your voice calls. That's a very different world than the world we live in today, which has various types of cross-platform competition, intermodal competition, a variety of different types of ways to make a phone call, as is witnessed by the podcast we're doing right now. So one wonders, is this really a sensible position to take in a world where you already have a great deal of device and network competition? Moreover, I think we have to ask the question about whether or not the government should have the right to come in and tell private network developers how they're essentially going to impose their own charges, fees, or plans on consumers when it's a competitive market. I mean, there's just no reason to have mandatory device attachment or these sorts of rules in a competitive market.
And that's a key, is competitive market. Libertarians like us don't have a problem with the government telling a monopoly that they need to open up.
Right. Could I, Jerry, ask Tim a question?
Yeah.
Because something I haven't written about that I thought Tim might is, I believe the latest DMCA revision, or Congress has these revisions that are made by the Library of Congress. Wasn't there something about unlocking cell phones that was exempted from the DMCA, Tim, in the most recent round?
Yes, that's actually what I was just about to say. And so I think that's a good example of, for the people who do want to put weird devices or, you know, move their phones between different networks, there is at least some ability to do that, and I think that ability will expand as people find more clever ways to get around these rules. And at least for the next 3 years, the DMCA will be less of an obstacle than it used to be to that.
Right.
All right. Well, let's move on to XM Sirius. So these are the two satellite radio companies that have announced they would like to merge. But, of course, they're regulated by the FCC. And before they can merge, both the DOJ and the FCC have to approve that merger. And basically, I guess it's more than just an approval process, an antitrust approval process. It's also that as part of their licenses for the spectrum that they use, they agreed never to merge.
Right. And basically, that is the hang-up that many people at the FCC and in Congress have right now, is the technicality. It's a major technicality that there's something in law that says it's forbidden for them to get together in this fashion. Of course, the rules can change and markets change. And certainly when the digital audio radio spectrum was being allocated in the mid and late 90s, it was a very different world in terms of what competition was out there for our ears. I mean, there wasn't anything such as iPods. There weren't any, you know, MP3 players were just coming out. I mean, you didn't have the kind of vibrant market of internet radio and online digital music services. And there's so many other types of things that compete for our attention of our ears. I'm a huge fan of Pandora.com, the wonderful online music service that serves up all sorts of free music to me just based on other artists I like. So all of these things now compete for our ears. And so XM and Sirius are competing against them. And the question is, can the market sustain two independent satellite radio carriers who happen to be A, losing money hand over fist, even though they're B, continuing to pass out contracts to high-priced talent, and C, do it all while they're facing off against all those competitors? I think that's a big stretch, and frankly, they still haven't turned any revenue. At some point, one of them is probably going to go under. I certainly hope it's not XM, because I happen to have three subscriptions, and I don't want them to go away. So I'd like to see, at a minimum, they be allowed to get together if things get bad enough. But I don't see any reason to stop this petition moving forward right now to preemptively deal with that problem for them.
You know, one thing I thought was interesting, I heard a Wall Street Journal reporter talk about this. She was saying how Kevin Martin, whose hobby horse is indecency, it seems, is thinking that that might be a condition for a possible merger, that they would accept indecency rules. And, of course, that would cut right into the Howard Stern and Opie and Anthony sort of thing. What do you think about that?
I think that's always a danger. It's something that I think this FCC is particularly interested in doing, which is trying to use the merger process as essentially an extortion racket to engage in regulatory blackmail and force people to do things they don't want to do, like, quote-unquote, clean up the airwaves. And so that's a risk, but I don't think it's as big of a risk as the other thing that could be attached as a condition of this deal if it goes forward, which is some sort of restriction on the ability of satellite radio providers to engage in localized, quote-unquote, programming. That is, they want to provide more local traffic, news, weather, and sports in a local city-by-city or community-by-community basis. Currently, they don't do much of that, but they're starting to. But the broadcasters, traditional radio broadcasters, and the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, are seeking legislation, which currently has over 80 co-sponsors, that would directly prohibit them from engaging in that sort of direct competition at the local level, fearing that it somehow is going to cut into free over-the-air broadcasting. I could easily see something like that being attached to this merger before XM and Sirius were allowed to get together. Essentially, protectionism for the broadcasters.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, you know, let's give Congress some credit. Over the last 10 years, there really haven't been any, quote-unquote, line-of-business restrictions imposed by law on new industry entry. This used to be a huge problem in our country. We'd have our government going to bat for industries and saying, you can't go into this new field. Now, I suppose you could find some examples at the margin, but for the most part, we don't keep competitors out of new industries or markets they want to go into, again, for the most part. But here we would be doing that. We'd be saying satellite radio wants to offer an innovative new service at the local community level, and yet we would be directly forbidding it through a line of business restriction. That's turning back the clock by 10, 20 years in terms of where we've been heading in, on the deregulatory front in America.
You know, I see the House, it's a new House Antitrust Task Force, is holding a hearing next week on the merger, and Mel Karmazin, who's the chief executive of Sirius, is going to be there. It's funny, this Antitrust Task Force next week is also holding a hearing on the future of digital music and competition, Tim, so keep an eye on that. But, you know, if this goes to Congress somehow, I'm curious how somebody like John Kerry would side on this. He has a bill right now, or I'm sure if it's a bill or if he's just holding hearings. Basically, DirecTV, I think, signed an exclusive contract with Major League Baseball so that the games would only be available on DirecTV, or out-of-town games would only be available on DirecTV. And he's up in arms that, you know, fans of the Red Sox can't watch it on their local station. And yet here is Sirius and XM, who one has NFL, one has Major League Baseball, are going to merge, so you can have both on in the combined entity. I wonder how he's going to feel about that.
I think that's what makes this deal more attractive to a lot of current subscribers, but I can see some members of Congress, I guess, nitpicking. But like you say, they'd be hypocrites if they did, if they're also going after DirecTV for having exclusive deals on the television front. But, you know, I don't know. I think the problem is that we face an environment right now where the media ownership issue and the whole question of media power is such a hot potato in Washington, and there are so many groups like MoveOn.org and Free Press and others who are agitating at this at the grassroots level, saying that any sort of combination in the media industry is somehow per se evil and therefore must be forbidden. And that's the environment XM and Sirius are walking into. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, you know, media consolidation aside, you know, and regulation aside, as a consumer, you know, I've basically been waiting to pull the trigger on either of these two services out of confusion and out of an inability to make a decision. There are aspects of both services that I find very appealing. And in a sense, it's kind of been like an HD DVD Blu-ray thing for me. I don't feel comfortable with the financial condition of either service. I look at them. You see over the last year, both the services have lost, 40% of their, of their market value. Knowing that I could get, all my national propaganda radio programming and my, my baseball and commercial free music is a very appealing option to me. And I would also feel, more comfortable investing in the hardware, not worrying that I was backing the wrong horse.
And PJ, I think that's a good point. And I think the last point you raised about the hardware is an important one, because one of the things that could hang up the deal is, will the deal, by merging the two companies together, affect existing hardware and all the gear that consumers have invested millions of dollars in the aggregate to put into their cars and into their homes and in their pockets? Because I know people like me with three subscriptions, and there are a lot of people that do have two or three subscriptions, would be very angry if all of a sudden all that gear stopped working one day.
Do you think that's legitimate for the antitrust authorities?
I think XM and Sirius will deal with this preemptively.
Right.
In fact, they've already hinted in their initial merger petition that they're going to make sure that existing consumers are made whole or remain whole, because they know they can't alienate the early adopters. That is the kiss of death in the world of entertainment and electronics. You don't want to piss off the people who provide you with your money up front and are the guinea pigs for your new devices. They're your loyal people. You got to keep them happy. So they're going to have a way to do this, but the question is, when they merge the channels and stations together, what goes? Because we're only going to need so many channels of classic rock, right? So does somebody's favorite channel on Sirius not make the cut in favor of the XM station that's similar? that's going to create some problems, but they're just going to have to deal with it. That's part of the consolidation process.
Well, Sirius has three birds in the air right now, and they've got a ground spare. XM has two birds, and they've got two in-flight spares that are already orbiting. They're not going to, you know, the satellites are up there. You know, there's no way they're going to dump their existing, any part of their existing subscriber base, given how much money they're spending acquiring each new customer. I mean...
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think because of the satellite capacity that's up there already, they'll be able to handle what's currently out there. But the question is, will they seek to consolidate existing channels in order to somehow cut back on some of the redundancy, if you will, associated with some of the program genres they have right now?
Well, one last point before we move on. You know, I want to really give props to Patrick Ross, our friend from PFF. I mean, I'm quoting him here for something he said in the blog post. He said, if Spectrum were treated like property as it should be, XM and or Sirius would long ago have sold their, quote, land to someone who could make money off of it, and it wouldn't have been a satellite radio, I'd bet. So, I mean, what he's saying is that, you know, if it's not working, it's the FCC license. It's locking them into a business model, isn't it? They, you know, they can't just turn around and say, well, this isn't working. There's not room for two competitors. I want to turn around and use the spectrum for WiMAX or something else.
That's right, Jerry. I mean, you just said it best. I mean, when you get a license from the FCC, it basically limits what you're allowed to do and how you're allowed to use it. And that is a highly inefficient way to allocate and use a scarce resource like spectrum. They ought to be able to sell it and use it however they want, but that's not the way the FCC works. They set all these ground rules. Essentially, they zone the spectrum to say you can only do this with it. And that's a really terrible way to run a market, but that's the way they're doing it.
All right. Well, that's a good segue to what's next, which is Spectrum Commons. And I just had an article published by the Stanford Technology Law Review in which I argue that despite the rhetoric from its proponents, a Spectrum Commons is just another form of regulation. And in 2002, the FCC came out with a study that it had been studying, I guess, for a long time called the Spectrum Policy Task Force Report. And it said basically that there were three ways you could regulate spectrum. One is the way they have been doing it for the past, you know, how long, Adam?
70 years.
Yeah, which is command and control. And that's what they called it in their report, which is exactly what you said. It's a zoning of what you can and can't do with spectrum and then doling out licenses to whoever the FCC thinks is best fit to have the license. The other option is privatization, where you basically auction off the spectrum like you would, you know, any other property and have a market. And the last is a commons, where basically you set some limits to what can be done on the spectrum, but then you let anybody who respects those rules on the commons. And a lot of folks, with, you know, including Lawrence Lessig, Yochai Benkler, and some others, have really been pushing for this commons model. And that's for example, that's how Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, these all operate on spectrum commons. The problem, you know, that I identified in my paper is that these folks propose this as a third way between regulation, between command and control, where the spectrum is under the control of the government, and privatization, where the spectrum is under the control of the market. They're saying, make the spectrum free, make it a commons, it'll be under no one's control, and it's a third way without the nasty stuff of that you get from regulation or the nasty stuff that you get from privatization. And my point is basically that a commons needs an owner in order for it to work. Look at Central Park. You know, Central Park is a commons. Anybody can go in there and use it, but New York City is the owner. And if you didn't have New York City as the owner setting rules of when you can use a baseball diamond, you know, how late you could be there, it would basically have what is referred to often as a tragedy of the commons. So, you know, Lessig and Yochai Benkler and Kevin Warbach, while they call this a third way, they admit that you have to have some regulation to make the commons work. And my question is, well, if you need some regulation, they say, oh, it's very light regulation. Well, how is this regulation going to be any different than regulation that we have now? You're still going to have special interests trying to push it in the way that they want. The FCC is going to pick an arbitrary technology to go on there. So, yeah, I don't see how it's any different.
I think it's. I thought your paper was very good, Jerry. I guess I would be inclined to play a little bit of a devil's advocate. I mean, you mentioned Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, And those seem to me of like examples where, yes, there's regulation, but pretty much the regulation is just don't, you're not allowed to exceed power level X in your transmission, and below that power level, you're allowed to pretty much do whatever you want with the spectrum. So, I mean, do you think that's an exception, or how would you deal with that?
No, I think that's right. So a couple things. Number one is you're saying the FCC says below power level X, you can do anything you want. Well, that presumes that the FCC somehow knows what is the optimal power level. If you had private entities competing in a market for the spectrum, you would get an optimal use of that spectrum. Here the FCC is just saying, this is it, and we've just arrived at this without any price signals. We've just arrived at it just sort of by looking into our crystal ball, and maybe also with, you know, by being influenced by other interests.
Don't you think if wireless device makers were completely unregulated in the amount of power they could use for transmission, we'd have, you know, some kind of arms race going on where, you know, my personal home network you know, wireless transmission equipment would try to broadcast a signal so strong that I wouldn't get any interference from my neighbors two blocks away?
That's right. But what Tim is saying, though, is that what the FCC would do is that they would set rules. So your scenario where there would be no power requirement or no power limit wouldn't happen. The FCC would set a rule, and this is what Leslie and Benkler say would happen.
Jerry, let me ask you, isn't it the case, or is the issue here really the question of whether or not commons-based models can scale? Because you talk about something like garage door openers and remote controls. I mean, those are two examples of devices that work on spectrum that's largely an unregulated commons, but one that's basically within throwing distance of your own body, right?
Right.
So would that scale to, say, an entire city, an entire region, entire nation?
No, it wouldn't. And that's what I was going to say to Tim. Basically, Wi-Fi is often touted as proof that a commons works, and it's absolutely true. A commons does work, and I have nothing against a commons, and I think that the FCC, if it wants to, just the same way New York City decides that it wants to have certain part of land dedicated as a park that it basically manages for the good of everybody, FCC should definitely do the same thing with spectrum. But let's not turn all spectrum or even a large portion of the spectrum into a commons. And the reason is, as you say, Adam, Wi-Fi works because your physical property rights allow it to work. If you have a Wi-Fi router in your home, it works within your home, and you can control any interference that would come in your home. If you're getting interference from your wireless handset for your phone, if you're getting interference from that to your Wi-Fi, you can just turn it off within your domain. So Wi-Fi works within a coffee shop, within a university campus, because it's under the control of somebody. Once you scale it to a city, you're going to get interference that, because it's an unregulated spectrum and you can't tell somebody else they can't transmit, you're going to get interference. And also, it's just cost prohibitive.
Yeah, I agree with that. And this is one of the things I find puzzling about the Benkler-Lessig position, because the premise here seems to be that the entire spectrum has to be a commons in order for whatever, you know, whatever protocols or whatever they want to work. But if their premise that spectrum is non-rivalrous is true, then you should be able to set off a third or 10% or some slice of spectrum for these non-rivalrous uses. And if it's really non-rivalrous, that should still be enough for them to do the various kinds of applications. So it seems to me a sensible compromise would be, you know, propertize most of the spectrum and set aside some spectrum for applications like Wi-Fi, and you can quibble over, you know, what exactly the breakdown between them is. But the spectrum commons people seem to spend a lot of time attacking the idea of private spectrum, when I think both sides agree that private spectrum is preferable to the command and control model that dominates now. And so it's kind of strange that they seem more upset about the idea of people having private ownership of spectrum than they are about the continuation of the current system that everybody agrees doesn't work.
I think you're right that would be a perfect compromise. And Larry Lessig makes a point always of saying that he wants to basically have a competition, basically set some spectrum off for a common, some spectrum off for privatization, and see which one is better, having a grand experiment. But yet, every time
new spectrum is up for allocation at the FCC, the proponents of a commons say, no, it has to be a commons, it has to be a commons, it has to be a commons. So I'm waiting for them to say, okay, this is the one that we want to be private. So anyhow, so that's Spectrum Commons. Well, you know, that's all the time we have for Tech Policy Weekly. As you may know, this is our first broadcast, so you can expect the production quality to get much better over the next few shows as we find our podcasting legs. To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. And if you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, and don't forget to dig our podcast. So until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.